Philadelphia, among 28 lodges located all over the world, the Lodge in Philadelphia holds two weekly meetings, and the purpose is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And as you see, I'm reading that from this little yellow pamphlet, and this is a four-page printout that if this is your first visit, you should pick up at the usher's table or at the book table in the middle of the room. Many carry this along with them on a daily basis because there are gems of information in this little pamphlet. And of course, we want to remind you that everything is carried on by voluntary contributions, and that is in time and work also. Those on the platform are volunteers, and they volunteer to give out these ideas for the benefit of visitors and regular attendees both. Now, we remember I said two weekly meetings a month, a week. And one is on the main one, Wednesday evening, begins promptly at 6:45 and lasts till 8:00. Quarter to eight and lasts to 9:00. And it's a study class usually in the ocean of theosophy at the present time. And there will be a question and answer period, and everyone is invited to participate, visitors as well. Sunday, as you see, we began promptly at 11 a.m. And this is June the 2nd. And for the whole month, we'll be talking about the mysteries of mind. Today, theosophy in everyday life. To be brief, we'll read the Declaration of ULT. And from this reading, we'll get the idea, the main seed idea. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but doesn't concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it to time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. Now, on Wednesday evening, the doors open here at 5:30. and you have at least 2 hours to visit in the library, where you will find basic philosophical literature, pamphlets, magazines, and other references. There'll always be a volunteer there to introduce you to the layout in the library and perhaps bring you out here and show you these rooms. You have 15 minutes. The library closes at 6:30, and you have 15 minutes before the meeting begins. We think we covered the most important ideas that this little pamphlet has to present to you. And we recommend that you carry it with you and open it and read it when you have some leisure time. As is the custom, before we begin our talk this morning, there will be a reading. And this particular reading is taken from a little pamphlet or a little book called Light on the Path. Do it. Kill out ambition. Kill out desire of life. Kill out desire of comfort. Work as those work who are ambitious. Respect life as those who desire. Be happy as those are who live for happiness. Live neither in the present nor in the future, but in the eternal. Kill out all sense of separateness. Kill out desire for sensation. Kill out the hunger for growth. Grow as the flower grows unconsciously, but eagerly, anxious to open its soul to the air. So must you press forward to open your soul to the eternal. But it must be the eternal that draws forth your strength and beauty, not desire for growth. Desire only that which is within you. Desire only that which is beyond you. Desire only that which is unattainable. For within you is the light of the world. The only light that can be shed upon the path. And if you are unable to perceive it within you, it's useless to look for it elsewhere. It is beyond you because when you reach it, you have lost yourself. It is unattainable because it forever recedes. You will enter the light, but you will never touch the flame. And it said this morning, June the 2nd, Theosophy in Everyday Life.
As is not our custom, we have a little short PowerPoint presentation. Why? Because in everyday life of every one of us, we are faced with either the benefits or the challenge of technology. Everything was working perfectly until we brought it downstairs. So, let's see what happens. I don't believe in laughing at equipment. It'll get you. I wonder if I say please. See, it won't move down just an inch. Anybody smart enough to make that happen? All right. It's very frustrating. It's like the mouse, which is wireless, is being rude.
let's put, can we make, how did you do that? Oh, it won't work in air. Thank you very much. I get it. No. I get it now. I assume wireless just be in the air. Oh. It wants a bottom. Maybe this is a clue for life. How interesting. Thank you. In case you can't read it, Denise Jacobson, born with cerebral palsy, considers her body as being on the spectrum of human variation, with nothing very notable to point out. Her life is lived by that mantra. This is Denise Jacobson. The article was in the New York Times on May 23rd. It was called "The Mind Inside." Do you love her? Look at her. She struggles to do everything. And she goes everywhere. She's married. They have a son they adopted when he was 3 months old. And she has a busy and full life. And I look at her calendar and I want to cry. She's willing to do that. And what are we doing? We take all our skills and possibilities for granted, and someone like this rejoices in what she has. I think this is one of the most beautiful pictures I have ever seen in my life. And if anyone wants a copy, I made some. She and her husband just radiate joy. They represent to me theosophy in daily life. So let's put you to sleep and thank you again. Never occurred to me. And perhaps that's the biggest example we could use about this talk. It never occurred to me. Why don't things occur to us? Because we've been born usually into a religion, a family opinion, and we have certain ideas that we accept, act on, and live by without ever questioning their validity or if they are true or meaningful for us. It never occurred to me. We look at someone like Denise, and if you can, go online and read the article, New York Times, May 23rd. She does not complain. Why do we complain? Well, the bus is very late, and my feet hurt. But you know what? Those aren't complaints. Those are facts. It's a fact you have in your life that you have certain problems and conditions. That's not a complaint. So what is the problem for us then? It's how we feel about those conditions, those problems. It's our attitude, and our attitude is fundamental. We have to discover that about ourselves. What is it we are expecting? What do we think is the way life works? You know, poets, in even the mundane, ordinary poetry that most people are familiar with, not necessarily the ones that are so beautifully over our heads, but ordinary poetry. For instance, Tennyson. They leave us such clues if we'd really think about it. I must work through months of toil and years of cultivation upon my proper patch of soil to grow my own plantation. I'll take the showers as they fall, enough if at the end of all a little garden blossom. If we could perceive our life that way, it is your little garden, you are responsible for it, the weeds, the soil, the whole thing, and be grateful if a little garden blossoms. You know, in the Key to Theosophy, HPB says one of the most, trying to think of a word that expresses how jubilant you feel that there's this possibility. There has to be a word like that. If someone thinks of it, just holler it out. She says that every flower you plant in another's garden, in another's life, eliminates weeds in your own. That is truly beautiful. Then there's this one. We learned this one as a child by John Burroughs. Asleep, awake, by night or day, the friends I seek are seeking me. No wind can drive my bark astray, nor change the tide of destiny. The stars come nightly to the sky, the tidal wave unto the sea, nor time, nor space, nor deep, nor high, can keep my own away from me. Now that is the statement of karma. The everyday life we are experiencing was preordered by ourselves, by the way we thought, by the way we acted, by the way we felt. We told life what we want. Tell life enough that you hate something, and it's guaranteed it's going to be piled at your door until you learn to say, oh, I understand that. I don't hate it. All life wants from any soul is growth, love, sharing. As long as we think in the terms that we have been brought up, that we are separate, that we're perishable, we have a use-by date, as long as we think that way, we're going to act that way. If we begin to realize, as these poets did, nothing can keep my own away from me. Good, bad, or indifferent, I am a dynamo, and I magnetically attract everything back to me that belongs to me. Now, this can sound very depressing. We have no idea what things we might have done in another life. But there's something else to consider. We have no idea what good we might have done, what we've learned, what we've been able to share and to grow with others. There is, as we know, just looking around the world, more good than non-good, but we just don't hear about it. Nobody cares to advertise it to us. We wonder how many recall, again, the New York Times, after 9/11, they printed daily lives of those who had been killed in the World Trade Towers, and every single human being mentioned in one of those little articles was shown to be brotherly, kind, generous with their time, loving with their family. It was as though there was this whole world of beautiful people you never knew existed. And then you stopped and realized, well, you know, that's true for all of us. How many people know the kind and good things you do? Usually just yourself and maybe a few close friends. If a paragraph or two were to be written about your life, you would like yourself. So there's all that to consider as well. There's beauty in all of us because we are all spiritual beings wrestling and fighting with the everyday conditions. But what Theosophy tells us is those are the only way to learn. You have to see the problem before you can ever hope to fix the problem. So life becomes just a workshop, an expression
of effort. From an article by a student, we thought this was so well stated. We all know that we have certain limitations, that there are certain weaknesses and blemishes within our own natures, but we have the power to remove them. Until we test that power, we shall never know whether it exists in us or not. The reality of a thing becomes clear only to the one who has tested the power of that reality. So, what shall we do with our minds? For it is our mind that holds the key to this. Too often we think that we are limited, but our limitations come from the ideas that we hold. If we believe we're weak and miserable, we're absolutely right. If we believe that we are spiritual beings, well, that is absolutely the truth. But until we recognize it and truly believe it, it's of no use to us. It's just another grand theory. Everything that you do, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, is done from one and the same power. The power of spirit. In other words, when you are rude and ugly and mean, it's from that same one power. It is your choice how you will use the force that you are. But then it stops being your choice when that force comes back to you, because it is like a swinging door. You push it, it's going to come back at you. What we have to learn is to be more gentle with ourselves, with our use of power, with everything about ourselves. And a statement by HPB that perhaps we often overlook, because in our everyday lives, we're all striving for happiness, for fulfillment, not just for ourselves, but for the loved ones around us, and maybe even for life itself, for the world itself. She said, "The needs of our spiritual nature can never be met other than by spiritual happiness." We're not going to find it here. If we win the lottery tomorrow or become the most successful author or whatever it is we think might lead to that happiness, it's not going to be here that way. How do we acquire spiritual happiness? Well, first, we begin to live by the principles of life. We're taught that compassion is not an attribute. It is the law of our very nature. So we begin where we find ourselves, acting in as compassionate a way as we can. And that takes discrimination. So it isn't just the mind. We have to work on the heart as well. We have to clean up our feelings. We have to begin to realize that we have to respect the rights of everyone around us and give them time to come to their own wisdom. This is from Mr. Judge, and we would recommend anyone interested in making an attempt at putting theosophy into your everyday life to read Mr. Judge, Letters That Have Helped Me, the Notes on the Bhagavad Gita. It's in there, he says, the first step in becoming is resignation. Resignation is the sure, true, and royal road. Assert to yourself that it is not of the slightest consequence what you were yesterday, but in every moment, strive for that moment, the results will follow of themselves. Now that may seem too simple, but if you imitate Denise and find no fault with the things that are happening in your life, with the conditions in your life, and strive to do your very best at that moment. Now, that doesn't mean overreaching. We know we all have that ideal to help the world, to save and serve humanity. But that's an ideal. We have to put it into the practical. And that means being polite to your neighbor who is so rude, being kind to your coworker who is so selfish. It means you have to apply the best that you have where you find yourself, or you'll never be able to serve humanity. Because that rude neighbor, that difficult coworker, they are not only humanity, they are yourself. Every problem you meet is you in another costume. That's why you're meeting that problem, so you can see its source, its seeds in yourself. So, theosophy in everyday life. If we'd stop finding fault with what's happening to us, perhaps we could use all that energy in a better way. We're sure you have questions. Yes?
In regards to Mr. Judge, we also like, he talks about all the obstacles that we perceive as being in our way from any kind of growth, that he says to change the idea from obstacle to opportunity.
Opportunity, yes. And that's become a very popular phrase in the world today. We're sure, like most of these things, if we were to trace it back, the Buddha said it. Every self-help book should start out with, thank you, Gautama the Buddha, because it's always based on his wisdom, which is based on truth, which is based on us. We have to learn who and what we are. We're a power. Yes?
The term light on the path, it's very poetic. We're thinking of a path as something that we are trying to find our way somewhere. Could you give us an idea of how the term path relates and also light?
Well, we don't think we're trying to find the path. We think we're on the path. And the Theosophy says you have to become the path to the higher nature. One of our biggest difficulties is how we identify with ourselves. We know we have a lower nature, personal desires, miseries and complaints and negative feelings about things. But we also know we have a higher nature. So many times we think we're the lower nature trying to reach up to the higher. Well, it can't be done. We are the higher nature working through the lower nature, trying to like tame it and bring it up. So where we place our identity is how we create the problem. We think we're on the path fighting with all these obstacles, when really the obstacles are our opportunities to get higher up on that path. But if that becomes our desire, here's what I want to do, I want to advance my development, we're going to start working backwards. Because the object of being on the path is to be the light on the path for others. It's that everything we learn, we have to be ready to share, to give away. In letters, Mr. Judge says an amazing thing, that we should be willing, even if it means that the other steps on us to go further, we should be willing to sacrifice our growth for the growth of those around us. Which, you know, think about it, that's a strange little paradox. If you really did that, if you laid down your life in that sense for another, but your growth rather than your physical life, that very desire has moved you forward as well. So in a way, you know how the expression, no good deed goes unpunished? Well, the true expression is, no good deed goes unnoticed. Even if no other individual knows, it is in your nature and you have lit that light. And they say a master will recognize us when we're ready to be their real true disciple because of the lights we have lighted in ourselves. So we have to be our own light on the path. But everyone is on that same path, whether they realize it or not. Yes?
To elaborate on something that you said, which I found really helpful, in trying to overcome these, I mean, we all have things that we don't like about ourselves, I think.
And even if we're wrong.
Well, we might be wrong.
Right.
But there are often things that irk us about other people. There's this person, this coworker, or whoever, who really strains me. And I found that if you search within yourself, do I have that characteristic that irks me so much about that other person? Then I know why it irks me. And then it goes back to me.
To fix it in you.
And fix it in myself.
Yes. You know, sometimes...
this in every situation of life. It's
very difficult. Sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes we are so blind to ourselves. But it can also be difficult in the trying to compare. We recall an experience dealing with someone, and we kept going, but we're not unbrotherly like that. We're not. And we could never figure it out until we suddenly changed the question. Well, if we're not unbrotherly like that, how are we unbrotherly? And it's very difficult when all of that becomes revealed to you. Sometimes when you see the problem in yourself, you are so appalled that you have been walking around all this time with that in your nature that it really stops you for a moment. But we have to remember there's not just that. We are not just the problems. We are also the skills and talents we have built up, and we are the courage that is looking at that very condition itself. What could be more wonderful? Yes?
Here's a corollary to that. That you just said about you find this in yourself and you can't believe that, you know, I am like that? Am I really like that? That is where you have to start loving yourself and embrace that, what you consider a negative thing, and see, well, explore it. But above all, learn to love yourself.
You know, one of the things about getting older is you find that you are sending apologies back into the past because you suddenly realize why all these people were doing these very stupid things that you couldn't tolerate. We have to learn at the time that we're reacting to something to be a scientist, to say, okay, this person is really pushing my buttons. But they're my buttons. Therefore, who has control of them? I do. So I am going to take note of what did they just say? How do I feel about it? What is the source of this difficulty and problem? It's not the other person. It's in me. So we have to have the courage to do that. Yes?
There was a concise quote like that. It says, it's not what people call me. It's what I answer to.
Oh, that's nice. It's not what people call me, it's what I answer to. You know, theosophy would add that it's not so much what life gives you as how you use it. You know, it's that, you know, make lemonade out of lemons. You know, if you really stopped and thought about it, picture yourself back in some ancient time. you couldn't have these ideas to discuss, whether freely or not. I mean, you had to, I suppose you wanted to be a student of Pythagoras. Have any of you ever read about what you had to go through? First 7 years of silence. Well, we wouldn't make that one at all. Then you would be given one idea. You would then spend a year pondering that idea. Eventually, if you endure, you would be able to share with a few others at about the same level. There's a wonderful article in magazine Theosophy about the Pythagorean school with this delightful little account of a Pythagorean student walking by this inn and going in and giving the owner money. And he was like, why are you doing this? And he said, well, there's a little symbol painted on the outside of your building which says, I, a Pythagorean student, was unable to pay my full bill. Will someone else do it? So there's a whole code of messaging with each other and a whole code of honoring for each other. In other words, I don't care who you were, my fellow student, I will pay your debt. That's truly beautiful. Yes.
Well, what do we do if someone, if you see something that somebody might need, but then there's karma coming in, so there's always that question, should I let them deal with it themselves, or has this come to me because I need to help them?
You know, if we start laboring over questions like that, we won't move at all, because everybody can see 16 sides to every possibility. First of all, if something comes to you, you are already part of it. Then your discrimination has to kick in. If I provide what this person needs, am I going to be crippling them, slowing them down? That's something you have to weigh and consider. Am I going to be embarrassing them, shaming them? Again, you have to consider. But if you decide that it is the right thing to do, you jump in wholeheartedly and do it and learn the lesson if it blows up in your face, which is why it takes so long. We're told we've been at this for 18 million years. Because we won't learn the lessons from things. We want what we want in spite of how we act. We have expectations. If something comes to you, act on it to the highest possible motive you can and learn from the results. Yes?
A simple example. You're walking down the street and person stumbles and falls. You're right there. Do you walk by?
We hope not.
Or do you say, can I help you? I have fallen on the street and I had three people coming to me and saying, you know, come on.
We fell last week, but it was at right in front of the hospital, and three nurses picked us up. We just laughed out loud because it was just perfect. Of course we should help.
I mean, you don't even think about it.
Right. But, you know, there's a whole fear cycle in people. Sometimes they fear to touch someone because they might have some condition. Sometimes they fear a kind of legal responsibility. If I touch you and you have a broken ankle from your fall, are you going to say it's because when I picked you up, it broke? I mean, people have 1,001 reasons. What we have to realize is we do not, beyond common sense, have to protect ourselves. We shouldn't be out wandering in a difficult neighborhood in the dark at night. That's just dumb. But we don't have to be fearful, because even if we die tomorrow, we're back before you know it. So we have to just relax. This life is a temporary vehicle for ourselves as a thinker. We will have many, many, many more lives in which to complain and maybe not help people until we finally learn we are here to help each other. Yes?
How do you address the problem that so many people encounter today with they meet someone who needs something, whether they're going to say, could I have a dollar, I haven't eaten, or whatever, and they are immediately confronted with, well, if I give him the dollar, he's going to buy drugs,
right,
he's going to buy
right.
alcohol, he's going to do this. My understanding, which is no guide for anyone but me, is that if someone asks you, your responsibility is to help in the best way possible. If they deceive, they don't deceive you, they deceive themselves. They said they needed it for this, and they said they needed it for that. If they use it for that, that's good. But you do what you can. That's your part of the karma.
Well, we agree. We always go with the gut. And if your gut tells you yes, then you do it. But you have nothing to do with the result. If they buy drugs or alcohol, it isn't you buying the drugs or the alcohol. We had a friend, a fellow student, whose solution was, if somebody specifically asks you money for food, take them out to eat. Take them out to eat. Don't give them the money. Yes.
But
they often refuse.
The other side of that, too, is also, do you diminish them? Do you diminish their ability to do what they say they want to do if you do this?
If you take them out to eat?
Yes.
No, actually, you are giving them the dignity of being on the same human level with them, no matter what their condition. The friend that told us about this did it many, many times. And an experience that we had just around the corner from here that was so profound, we came home and wrote down the words to the song that was sung, was three people asking for money for food. And my friend went in and bought sandwiches and coffee and brought it back out. And the woman, never seen her before, never seen her since, still have the feeling this might not really have ever happened, but the other person was a witness to it. She started singing in the most beautiful voice, "Oh, Master, do not take my troubles from me. Help me climb the mountain so I can see better what it is you want me to do." Who ever heard of such a song? We've searched for it. It doesn't exist. We've never seen those people before or since. But it all happened over a request for food, and then it was given to them. So we don't think you diminish someone. We think you diminish someone if you say, "No, I'm not going to give you money. You'll probably spend it on drugs or alcohol." That's telling them that you judge them completely. But we think if you say, "I'm sorry, I don't have any money. I can't spare any money," that's not diminishing them either. One of my favorites was a very flippant friend, but a very nice person. Someone stuck out their hand and said, "Change." And he said, "You don't know how I've tried." And just kept on walking. Really happened. Yes.
For the last comment, it's a perfect example. We have tried independently, based on some of the ideas that we might have received here, where we are instantly attacked by an angry person, mm-hmm. or in words or whatever. And since these teachings sort of keep my heart charged up, smile, mm-hmm. and even crack a joke, mm-hmm. instantly the other person's anger turns into a grin and a laugh. proceed to correct whatever is wrong. So it seems the heart is a very vital part of light on the path.
Yes, the heart, but there's also your karma. We used to have a man who sat on the steps next door all the time, and we always gave him our spare change. He was a very pleasant man. And one time we literally didn't have any. And we said, "I'm sorry, I don't have any." And he started chasing me with a stick. Block and a half I was running going, "I don't believe this." I think he got worn out, so he went back, and I made sure I had change in my pocket from then on, because he was serious. He really did not believe me. So I think there's a whole undercurrent that we don't recognize of pain and suffering. It's not just people that we see on the street. You know, in this kind of weather condition, you often hear of old people alone who are dying because they sit in their hot place, they don't open the window, they just run a fan, which makes it a convection oven. So where the oven outside temperature is 95, the fan manages to make it up to 105 in their room. So there's homeless in more than one sense. We've got to become more of a family to each other, to look out for each other, to honestly care about each other. If you can care about other people, you have to act on it. So it begins with the heart, as you said. We have to awaken within us care. Care comes from caritas, which the word charity comes from as well. But we should never think of it as charity, because charity has a negative sort of thing. I think it was Jesse Jackson who said, "Never reach down to help somebody unless it's to give them an arm up." So, yes?
I want to share one of the instances of karma. A little child drowned, and the parents asked, "How could it happen? Why? The answer was, this soul did not help someone who was drawing in the previous life, when this soul was an adult, but the soul could have helped pull someone out of the world and decided not to intervene.
Yeah, we understand. We do pay as much for the things we don't do as for the things we do. And then we're back to, if you come into a situation, your choice has to be, what is the best that I can do at this moment? We make it all so complicated, and it really is so simple if we would just stop and realize. We think someone else is going to save us, or some routine, or some belief, some practice. You know, there are places in the world where people believe if they just keep saying the name of a certain being over and over, they will be lifted into some heaven state. Well, that makes no sense if you stop and think about it. So obviously these people are not thinking about it. It's our job to think. We're thinkers. Think first, then act. But we can't know, why is this happening to me? Why do I have this difficult situation? If we try to focus on why, we'll never get to how. How do I act in this problem? How can I do the best I can with my limited resources? Not why. Why is I made choices and actions in the past, and that's the result. Yes?
It just came to our mind. What does the Statue of Liberty and Governor's Island in New York indicate? There's a practical purpose involved in that.
Well, you're going to make us want to cry, because
there's practical tragedies involved in it as well. In spite of what it says, that isn't what we always do. Give me, you're tired, you're poor. No, we don't always do that. We set up limitations and... this is a silly little story, but at some point, we think in the early 60s, our government allowed a certain number of Greeks to come to immigrate into the United States. And one of them was my husband's aunt. And she always said, in very broken English, if I ever see Harry Truman, I'm going to kiss his feet. Well, that's fine. Everyone should have a goal, right? So the entire family is at O'Hare Airport in Chicago because my husband's parents are returning from their first trip to Greece since they left there as teenagers. And someone says, I understand President Truman is here somewhere. Well, he was the former president. And I went, oh, no. And I took off running. And there she was on the ground, kissing his feet. And the Secret Service are trying to pull her off. And he's saying, no, no, let her. I understand. And he did. He understood this passion that you would feel that you had a goal in life and you wanted to do this thing and here was your opportunity. So my husband and I stood there and talked to former President Truman for a while. Little bit of a fellow, but very dynamic. It was a beautiful experience. And she radiated for at least a month afterwards. Yes.
He's an interesting study too, President Truman.
Mm-hmm.
It's the transformative power of duty. Because when he was a young man growing up, he was...
a haberdashery.
Well, that was his profession. But he harbored the feelings that that section of the country harbored. But when he became president, he was the one that integrated the armed services.
Mm.
He had transformed what he had grown up with into what was right.
Right. And you know, he was the one who said... no, I don't want any of these privileges for having served as president. And he gave up all of those rights and privileges, which we've had some amazing people. Yeah, that doesn't happen. Right? Yes.
Well, it's interesting.
I'm sorry, I called on someone. Yes?
It's interesting. We know that the mainstream media sometimes doesn't report a lot of things, but one thing that we have been noticing is that a lot of the stations are reporting human interest stories a little more frequent than they used to. But a lot of them have to do with somebody losing a spouse or a child or a dear friend, and they use that grief and the power that could have been used for getting depressed or whatever, they're using towards, you know, especially with the technology, you know, websites, you know, to help people. You know, they're reaching out, and whatever grief they had, they're using it towards helping others.
And many, many things have been done that way by small children. Children with an actual condition working to inform other children and to reach out. And children who are just observers of such a condition. The power and the force of compassion are huge. You know, they had an interview recently of five or six of the women from the Boston Marathon bombing, and all of them had lost at least one leg, and one of them had lost both legs, and they were interviewing them. They meet together frequently to support each other, and It was one point you had to laugh out loud because we didn't realize, and neither did the interviewer, that for women, when you are getting a new leg, the foot has to be able to be adjustable so you can walk in flats and heels. So it's delightful of technology to do that for us. But so these women were sharing their feelings, and they ended with the one woman who said, "I wish that the media would stop focusing on the perpetrators. I don't need to see any more of that. I don't need to feel any hate. We have to be about healing and helping each other to heal." Well, that could be like a mantra for all of us. We have to be about healing and helping each other to heal. Share whatever you can. Share books. Share movies, good movies. Share your life with people. Be present in other people's lives. And then you'll know if the need that you seek to help and assist in would offend or hurt them. You know, we can always sneak around things and do things anonymously. Yes, we can. We can give people something without them knowing that it came from us. And that way they may not be as insulted as they would be. Yes?
It is equally wrong to focus on perpetrators and the victims. It's wrong to idolize victims. It's right to honor those who help someone, who save someone, but to idolize victims, it's not the way to go.
Well, I don't think they were idolizing the victims. I don't think it was that. I think they were showing that these women had grouped together, and in grouping together, were helping each other. First of all, in this particular instance, there is nobody paying their medical bills, and a prosthetic leg can cost you $100,000. So they're doing a moral support of each other that is very important. I don't think anyone is idolizing them. No one wants to be a victim, so.
I know that the set up funds to raise money for them to recover.
It might be, you know. We don't know, but what an unfortunate karma. I mean, we all know how difficult it is to face the loss of a limb, but to face it and it wasn't your illness. You know, it's something from your past karma that you can't even know about, and it's financially going to destroy you. Yes?
I wanted to say, you know, when you were talking about victim or whatever, the ones who are doing all that for themselves, they're not really acting like a victim. They're not saying,
yeah,
for me.
That's
you're
true.
They're coming together to say, I'm empowered with this, and, you know, if they can do it for themselves, and someone else or another would get together and do it for themselves. So they're not really acting like they're victims.
You're absolutely right. And that was the feeling. And if anyone, we made some copies of the picture of the Jacobsons. She is not a victim of her cerebral palsy. She is this sterling example of how to move through life with joy in spite of your condition. She just celebrates being alive and having her son and her husband and all these activities that she does. I don't know about you, but I would love to have her courage. I can certainly have her joy. Yes.
There are many other examples. I mean, think of the scientist Hawking.
Stephen Hawking, yes.
And Christopher Reeve.
Yes.
And
well, we only picked this one
because
it's very current, and there is something about her face and her expression that when I look at her, I am full of joy. It's as though she's giving it to me. Well, our time is up, and we remind you that our subject for the entire month has to do with the mind, and that is where we live. Remember that. That's where you will find yourself. Meeting is adjourned.